I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax.
They control Aramco, so that puts them into Exxon, Texaco, and Mobil Oil. They're all over New Jersey, Louisville, St. Louis, Missouri. And that's only what we know about. There's a hell of a lot more we don't know about, because all of those Arab petrodollars are washed through Switzerland and Canada and the biggest banks in this country.
Did you learn things that you didn't think you could tell?
Absolutely. I've learned lots and lots of things I don't feel comfortable talking about. Interests, the real special interests behind coup d'etat all over the globe. The idea of coup d'etat is an amazing idea, and it goes on. I mean, I sat with a bunch of oil men, very powerful oil men.
Coup d'etat meaning overthrow a government.
Overthrow a government.
The world is a business. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet.
There is only one holistic system of systems. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, reichmarks, rims, rubles, pounds, and shekels.
The world is a business.
There are petrodollars.
The world is a business.
And I sat on Fifth Avenue, this 15,000 square foot apartment, just around the corner on Fifth Avenue, one of these brownstones. This guy owns the whole building, an oil man. And he and his friends played a little game at this table. Where they made a guess. They said, next country to be overthrown for its energy assets. And the one guy who was having the party, the richest one of them all, he had said at this dinner party, he said, "What? First question, what's the money for?" "Well, I buy media. I buy media, I buy stories, and I buy op-ed pieces, and I buy front page stories, and then I buy mobs. I pay off mobs to show up in the street on demand. That's what I do."
"Let me tell you what's going to happen. This way you can prepare yourself."
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Sorry if I threw you for a loop when it came to that different intro, but it was a little track I put together featuring audio from the movies Network and Lord of War, as well as a very interesting interview with the director of Syriana, conducted by Charlie Rose. Now, that was actually only part of the track. You'll be able to hear it in its entirety at the end of the show, so stick with us for that. Or maybe you just found it horribly obnoxious. I don't know whether people have liked this little experiment or not, but I wanted to try something new. Anyways, that little track was sort of a way to set the mood for the conversation we'll be having on this edition of the show with returning guest, journalist J.P. Satilli, a.k.a. The News Vandal. And we're going to be talking about what he calls the Empire of Oil, using the recent arrest of Trump loyalist Tom Barrack on charges of acting as a foreign agent for the United Arab Emirates as our launching point. JP and I will delve into a million different topics and try to tie them together, from the big UAE scandal to the recent revelations about NSO Group and Pegasus spyware. Trust me when I say it's a conversation that will go in a million different directions, but I think it is profoundly informative and goes a long way in explaining our current geopolitical situation, from spying scandals to the petro economy. Trust me when I say this is an episode you're not going to want to miss, and it is one wild ride. So let's get right to it with J.P. Satilli, the News Vandal, on the Empire of Oil.
Yeah.
Welcome to Parallax Views, the one and only JP Satilli, the news vandal, a man who I think has the gift of gab. Sometimes he gets a little on the doomy side, but, you know, he's a great speaker and he can talk doom without coming off like that crazy nut Alex Jones. And he's not going to sell you any super mill vitality pills or colloidal silver to make you blue because he's an honest man. How you doing, JP?
Wow, I don't know how I deal with an introduction like that. Where do you go from there? You go to Carol Monroe.
that's what I was going to say. You recently sent me something that fascinated me. Carol Monroe, the great actress who I believe she had a small part in a James Bond movie, and I feel bad because I'm blanking on the film.
The Spy Who Loved Me.
Yes, The Spy Who Loved Me. She's one of the villains, the pilot. But yeah. I know her from such classics as Slaughter High and Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. And boy, was she a looker. Check her out in the movie Star Crash, Star Wars ripoff from, I think, Italy. If people haven't seen that, my God, she looks beautiful in it. Princess Leia, eat your heart out. But I just found out from you, apparently she recorded a song or a track or a record with the 60s band Cream, right? Or the 70s band. Yeah.
Yeah, 60s band. Yeah. Before... Yeah.
I'm showing my lack of knowledge about 60s
before
rock.
Before Clapton went on his own and became, you know, Darth Clapton.
Eric Clapton.
Since we're doing Star Wars.
Was that before he did the Rivers of Blood speech?
Yes. Yes, well before.
We're getting inside baseball here.
And when he had the moderating influence of Ginger Baker there to guide him.
Okay, before we get into the main subject, favorite Carol Monroe movie? I know I'm putting you on the spot.
Well, see, I haven't gone down the rabbit hole. For me, and of course it's Spy Who Loved Me because she's amazing as an assassin in a helicopter. But, you know, I don't have the same voluminous knowledge of, what would you call them, horror B movies?
Yes, indeed.
Horror B movies.
Well, I have to be honest. I have a thing for the Bond girls. I love all the Bond girls. You asked me about the Bond girls: Carol Monroe, Britt Eklund. You know, I love them all. Even that chick. Who was the one chick that just passed away? That was on that 70s show.
Oh,
Tanya Roberts.
Yes,
she was a Bond Roberts girl too. She
from
was in the last Roger
View to
Moore
a Kill,
one,
which was really the low point for the Roger Moore portion of the Bond franchise.
Well, that's when he had the eye surgery and stuff was looking a bit odd. But you know what? Low point, but I love myself some Tanya Roberts and I love some Christopher Walken. Anyways, do you know who the only person to play a Bond girl twice is? Bit of trivia.
Oh, Maude Adams.
Indeed. Maude Adams in The Man with the Golden Gun and Octopussy.
Octopussy, man.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it. Anyways, we're here to talk about some Trump news in a way, and people always say, oh, enough of Trump, but this is actually really important because it ties into the United Arab Emirates. So what is going on and who exactly is Tom Barrack?
Tom Barrack or Barrack is a
sorry if I mispronounced.
Yeah. Of Lebanese Christian origin, grew up in Southern California, got a law degree, and starting in 1972. He started to work. He was working for a law firm out of Southern California. And one of his first gigs was working as a legal liaison between the Fluor Corporation and Saudi Arabia. And if you're not familiar with Fluor is a longtime military industrial complex heavy hitter, not on the weapons side, but on the construction side, bases and whatnot. As a matter of fact, in 2020, they just got a renewed contract to build and maintain bases in Afghanistan and Africa. So he has this long history with Saudi Arabia. And at that time, that's when he actually got to know a guy named Paul Manafort, who was also working on Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabian issues. And this is all happening at a time in the early 70s when the petrodollar comes into being. That's when your listeners, viewers will be familiar with this, but Nixon takes America finally off the gold standard forever, right? And cuts this deal with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia will engage in what's called petrodollar recycling. So the United States will be a guarantor of Saudi Arabia in perpetuity as long as Saudi Arabia takes the money that the United States spends on oil and pumps it back into the United States in real estate investments and, most importantly, in defense spending. And this creates the petrodollar recycling economy. And when people say, we're on a fiat currency, it's the dollar's not pegged to anything. I always counter that. I say, no, it's not pegged to gold. It's pegged to oil. It's pegged to a hard asset. Oil is the thing that keeps the dollar grounded and has done for the entirety of the empire of oil. But really, over the last 45, 50 years, it's been the thing that's kept the dollar floating in this sea of petroleum. So
you could call it the United States of oil.
The United States of oil. I like the empire of oil because as this story goes, it shows that Barrick and the UAE and its involvement with Trump. And I wrote a piece when the Mueller report came out. I call it a piece. It's 19,000 words.
The deep state of denial about Trump's oily presidency. I love that title.
And what occurred to me is, you know, there are a couple things in the Mueller report that never got talked about. It's the role of a guy named Rick Gerson, who's connected to Kushner, a guy named Kirill Dmitriev, who is head of the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Russia. And the Sovereign Wealth Fund, of course, is fed by what? It's fed by oil. So you have this massive amount of oil that he is able to, oil dollars that he's able to go out into the world and invest. And he's often investing side by side with the United Arab Emirates in their Sovereign Wealth Fund. And a guy named Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ. We know about MBS, Mohammed bin Zayed, but Mohammed bin Salman. But Mohammed bin Zayed is probably more important than Mohammed bin Salman. And it was reported at the time when Mohammed bin Salman rose to the top of the Saudi pyramid that MBZ was crucial in back-channel negotiations in getting MBS to that position. Well, this is where the UAE comes in. And the UAE seems to intersect with so many aspects of Trump's campaign and then Trump's presidency. And one of the nodes of that connection would be Tom Barrack. And Barrack, who just was released on a $250 million bond. Let's think about that for a second. So you go to bail hearing, right? Wow, $10,000, $100,000. This is $250 million, and he has to wear a bracelet and agree to only go to, I think, New York, Las Vegas, and Southern California. He can't leave the country because he's obviously a flight risk. I guess the $250 million is supposed to mitigate that possibility.
It reminds me of when I found out that Paul Manafort was allowed to, you know, he could wear the ankle bracelet and, you know, vacation in the Hamptons during Christmas.
Right. My God. Exactly. Oh. Exactly. So Barrack, he's being charged as a foreign agent who had not registered as a foreign agent. And they have oodles of information. They have text messages and phone calls and conversations. He was basically the UAE's man inside the Trump administration. And actually, he was the UAE's man inside the Trump campaign. And Barrack also then went on to chair the inaugural committee. And the inaugural committee raised over $100 million, double what Obama's inaugural committee famously raised. And we still don't have all of the information on all of the ways in which that was a slush fund. I mean, you know,
Didn't Jared Kushner do something with the UAE too that was like – it was just right out in the open, the big deal with the millions of dollars in fighter jets, I think, too.
Well, that comes later. That's the Abraham Accords, which Kushner organized. And the Abraham Accords – see, we can get to this. This is where I'm talking about I like to talk about the empire of oil, because what the Abraham Accords ended up becoming was a way for countries like the UAE to ensconce themselves in the military-industrial complex. The UAE – what they got for normalizing relations with Israel was access to the F-35 fighter, the Lockheed Martin Boondoggle, which I call the world's greatest flying ATM, because it's just a flying cash machine is what it is. So why would the UAE want to buy into a plane that is widely hailed as a boondoggle and is still having problems today? The United States is still having problems getting things off the ground. Well, once you get bought into a major weapon system like the F-35, you become a preferred customer of the United States and a preferred customer of the Empire of Oil, and as we know, the customer is always right. This is one of the reasons why Saudi Arabia can literally get away with murder of Khashoggi and literally get away with mass murder like 9/11, because the customer is always right. And when you're a reliable customer who is recycling petrodollars back in the United States economy, you can get away with murder.
I just want to comment real quick. I've been following the 9/11 families lawsuit when it comes to Saudi Arabia. I mean, you look at the FBI, they were saying Omar al-Bayoumi, the guy who was showing al-Hazmi and al-Midar, the two hijackers around and getting them places to stay in L.A., everyone basically knew Omar al-Bayoumi was, you know, Saudi intel. Now, the Saudis deny it, but it goes back to what you say. It's like, you know, Saudi Arabia gets away with a lot. I mean, to me, there's been pushback with the Jamal Khashoggi thing. Yeah. Hillary Clinton has even made comments, promoted that one documentary about Khashoggi's assassination. Yeah. But in a way, I think that's only because I'm – from my understanding, people I talk to, Khashoggi has connections to Turkey and the U.S. national security state. So maybe they overstepped their hand.
Well, yes, and I think also what we're seeing and what we have seen since the second Obama administration is the opening up of a rift in the U.S. foreign policy, national security establishment.
I think a lot of it is like what, Saudi Arabia versus Qatar in some ways.
Well, there's that, and we can talk about that and how Qatar was actually part of a shakedown by Jared Kushner's father, Charles Kushner. And the UAE is involved in that as well. And so is Thomas Barrack, where they Kushner, famously Jared Kushner, had 666 Fifth Avenue, right? The giant boondoggle, right? Amazing, right? You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, and people want to talk about Pizzagate. Oh, my God.
I know, and you got 666 Fifth Avenue, for Christ's sake. Anyway, so
– very fitting. Anyways, go on.
So Kushner was going to get them to float that property and take it off his hands. They were going back and forth, and Charles Kushner was handling the negotiations. Well, Qatar finally said, no, we're not going to do it. And shortly thereafter, the UAE and Saudi Arabia organized a blockade of Qatar. Huh. So was this a shakedown? Was this the price that they were paying? Was the UAE and Saudi Arabia involved in actually being enforcers on behalf of Kushner?
And I just wanted to add to that real quick, since people may get confused. You said Charles Kushner. That's obviously the father, right, of Jared.
That's Jared's father, yeah. So while Jared was ostensibly part of, you know, working the in the administration, his father was running this shakedown on behalf of his son. And then Rex Tillerson, some people like to call him T-Rexon. A friend of mine likes to call him T-Rexon, the great James Moore. Rex Tillerson is like, wait a minute, what the heck is going on here? And he is pushing back on this and saying this is counterproductive. Well, he almost got fired as a result of this because he was pushing back against what Kushner, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia were doing to Qatar. Well, Qatar, why is Qatar a marked man among not only because of the Kushner thing, but they're a marked man among the Emiratis and the Saudis because they sit on one of the world's largest gas reserves, the North Dome South Pars field, which they share with Iran. And Iran, by the way, has the world's second largest natural gas reserves. The largest natural gas reserves, that would be Russia, has the largest natural gas reserves. The UAE and Saudi Arabia do not have a lot of natural gas. The world has been heading towards natural gas, particularly as a bridge fuel to the future. Who called it a bridge fuel? That would be one Barack Obama. When Barack Obama opened the spigot on fracking, and he said, this is the way we get to a low carbon future. We transition out of dirtier coal and oil, and we go to natural gas. That, of course, pissed off many progressives and many environmentalists that Obama is really the author of the fracking boom in the United States. Although it is technically true that fracking, that natural gas is a cleaner way of burning hydrocarbons, the byproducts of fracking, like putting radioactive water into reinjection wells, obviously kind of cancels out all of the environmental benefit you get out of it. But what I see in retrospect in Obama's push for fracking is a geopolitical maneuver to try and cleave the United States from Saudi Arabia and move towards Iran, let Iran normalize its relations, get those natural gas reserves to come online. And what would that do? That would crush Saudi Arabia.
And of course, now it seems like, you know, I was just talking to the Harvard International Relations scholar, Stephen Walt, and I said, what do you think about the chances of us getting back into the JCPOA? And he's like, well, I think there's still hope, but the window is closing very rapidly. And Trump, his big thing was just crushed the deal with Iran.
And if you read my piece, the oily presidency, the deep state denial about Trump's oily presidency, my central thesis is that Donald Trump was hired for one thing and one thing only, to destroy the nuclear deal. That was job number one. And the thing that brought together the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Russia as a junior partner was this desire to jettison the Iran nuclear deal, to do a couple things. One, to reinvigorate a flagging oil market. The price of oil during Obama had dropped down to $26 a barrel. That's about $25 under the break-even price that you need on a barrel of oil. That fracking boom, not only did it take natural gas and elevate it as a hydrocarbon, but it was destroying the economy of Saudi Arabia. It was destroying the economy of Russia. It hamstrung Venezuela, destroyed their economy. And it forced, many people believe, helped force Iran to the negotiating table. So it was a major geopolitical move. I'm not in favor of fracking. I'm just describing. This was a sea change policy in 50 years of empire of oil standard practice.
Now, I want to get back to Mr. UAE foreign agent, Tommy B. But first, I wanted to ask you.
Tommy B. Yeah, let's call it. That's good. Tommy B.
But first, I wanted to ask you. So we have all this crazy news breaking in the past few months. We have a lot of anger still building over the stuff with Jamal Khashoggi. With Turkey, it was interesting. Air America is now doing some documentaries that are anti-Turkey a few months ago. And also, we have a lot of scandals with Israel now, especially this Pegasus NSO group scandal. What is going on here? Is there anything going on geopolitically where, you know, some more dirt is coming out about U.S. allies? What is this all about, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, the NSO group and the Pegasus scandal, this is just sort of de rigueur. This is how it's done now. This is how the United States has done it. You know, the NSO group's Pegasus spyware is categorized as a weapon by the Israeli government. So the Israeli government has to sign off on its sales.
And there's news articles saying they encouraged the sale of it to Saudi Arabia, even with all the pressure over the Khashoggi murder and the oppression.
Of course, because Saudi Arabia and Israel have interests vested with one another now. This is one of the outcomes of the backlash to Obama's moves against Saudi Arabia that led to the backlash, the Kushner organized backlash, which created a sort of a community of collective interest between Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Israel.
Real quick here, the thing that really fascinates me is you have Israel selling to multiple different countries. You know, leaders have been targeted, politicians, journalists, everyone. I mean, there's journalists in Mexico that went up against the cartels. They end up dead a few hours later. Lo and behold, the Pegasus spyware is on them, on their phones. But the thing that I find interesting is, you know, not only is there this allyship between Saudi Arabia and Israel, but my thinking is you can sell that software to Saudi Arabia, and if you have backdoors, then you can track them too.
Of course, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the biggest customers for this was Modi's India, and very important to Israel. Modi has been an important ally, was an important ally to Bibi Netanyahu. It's turned into a massive scandal there. But yes, these backdoors, and this is why I said it's de rigueur, because this is, you know, basically what the United States has been doing forever. The United States I'm still of the mind that the United States is still the hacking champion of the planet. I think that the capabilities have been downplayed, and a lot of these other stories kind of take over, and people kind of say, oh my God, is the United States losing the cyber war? You know, I'm not so sure. You know, I think just based on my experience, I think that the United States capabilities are significant. They may actually be extraterrestrial. I think that what we have in terms of spy satellites outstrips anything that the rest of the world has. So
when you say extraterrestrial, do you mean we get alien technology?
Alien technology. I'm just saying it's orbital. How's that? I'll say it's orbital. I just like to say extraterrestrial whenever I get the shot. Whenever, just like interloper. If I have an opportunity to say interloper, I'm going to say interloper. I don't know why. I just love these words. So, You know, the interesting thing about the NSO group, though, and Pegasus, is that I can connect it back to what we're talking about, because the UAE, there's a guy named George Nader, who you and your listeners and viewers will be familiar with, a thrice, I think, now convicted pedophile, not just twice, but I think thrice. I think it could be twice, but I think it's thrice. Also, I believe Lebanese American, who was a fixer of for Middle Eastern people who wanted to get into the Middle Eastern game over the last 35 years. Well, Nader organized a Trump Tower meeting. This is a Trump Tower meeting that people have never really talked about. Most people haven't heard of. And in the during the campaign, this is not before the election, not after the election, this is before the election, Nader takes representatives to the Trump Tower to meet with Don Jr. and a couple people. These are representatives of Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Zayed. And they say, hey, we really want your dad to win. So what we've got is this group here called the Psy Group. And what Psy Group does is they do influence campaigns, and they do many of the same things that the NSO group does.
And they're based out of Israel. And also, a lot of people did not mention them when the Mueller report came out. They sort of got, I think they, people forgot, or they it got lost in the details.
Got lost in the details. And I'll come back. Let me cycle back to that, because I'll tie that back into something I have to say about 9/11, by the way. So this Psy Group says we can run influence campaigns. We can do messaging. We can do influence operations. We can do many of the same things that Cambridge Analytica does. They were running anti-BDS efforts, for example. They actually got involved in a school board campaign in Turlock, California, I think as a proof of concept of what they do. They are now officially defunct. At the time, they were called a Mossad for hire. And I wonder how many of the Psy Group people ended up going into the NSO group eventually. So that is the kind of, by the way, many of the things that Psy Group said that they could do on the dime of MBZ and MBS, organized by Nader, and also with the cooperation, or at least the knowledge of Tommy B and Manafort. I'd also like to note that Manafort became Trump's campaign manager at the suggestion of Tom Barrack. We could just keep. I just feel like that, you know, is that famous meme of the guy. I don't know what show it's from.
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
What it is? Yeah. So he's got all the strings there. I mean, when you start talking about it, that's what you feel like. So this is why I'm saying it's a de rigueur. You know, the United States. Where do some of these private spying operations that the CIA contracts out to, you know, all these, you have tons of companies all there around the Crystal City and the Pentagon and in Arlington, Northern Virginia. So many of the United States spying capabilities are actually contracted out to subcontractors in the military industrial complex because layer of plausible deniability. This is kind of how it's done. It's like the Internet Research Agency in Russia. This is how it's done. This is how it's done. And I think maybe you were getting at this to get to a larger point. The NSO scandal is emblematic of the conflict between those who tend to be in power in ostensibly democratic countries, ostensibly. Many of them, they're becoming less and less democratic as authoritarians and populists take over, and their need to control the narratives inside their countries. And if that offers Israel a backdoor into those countries, great. But if it also keeps the status quo of the power paradigm, that benefits not just Israel, but all of the countries that it is selling to.
I was just going to add to that. You know, I was talking to Kelly Vlahos recently about the assassination in Haiti. And what we got into was private mercenary armies, because that figures into that story. So we have private mercenary armies, private spying intelligence groups. This is like, we live in a brave new world now.
Yeah, we absolutely do. So to cycle back on why this the second Trump Tower meeting never got talked about, and why the UAE has never been talked about, why Thomas Barrack, I mean, Tom Thomas Barrack should be as well known to every American as Jared Kushner, at least name recognition wise.
What makes him so bad?
Well, his fingerprints are all over everything that has to do with Trump's presidency and Trump's campaign. And his fingerprints, he is the handmaiden between the real power behind Trump's ascendancy and Trump. And that real power is the United Arab Emirates and its junior partners, Saudi Arabia and Russia. And I say junior partners, see, and this is how I'm going to cycle it back to 9/11. You know, when I go back to 9, there was a time when being a conspiracy theorist meant that you used, that you engaged in critiques of official narratives to try and discover the truth based on holes in the official narratives that the documents reveal. Now, being a conspiracy theorist means you are probably a profit-seeking fabulist. That's really all it is now. But there was, you know, back when the 9/11 thing happened, and then in the wake of 9/11, you get the rise. You said, well, I'm going to bring it up since you compared me, not to him, against him. I like to be compared against him, not to him. Alex Jones, right? Who benefited more from 9/11 than Alex Jones? I mean, only the people who wanted to keep Iraq's oil in the ground benefited more than Alex Jones. So in the, you know, 9/11, in the aftermath of 9/11, the conspiracy zone was flooded with directed energy weapons and planted bombs and all these plots and an inside job and who in the Bush administration was responsible? Who in the Bush administration was responsible? Well, as the 28 pages have revealed and FBI investigations that we know, what we know of those have revealed, and John
retired O'Neill, FBI agents like Mark Rosini and also Kenneth Williams. Yeah.
All these guys. So what they knew was that this was pretty much a Saudi operation. So when I talk about 9/11, I always call it the Saudi operation 9/11. You know, the irony being that the only country that's been given has a judgment against it, I think it's a like $6 billion judgment against it for responsibility for 9/11, is Iran, which had nothing to do with it. There actually was a judgment against Iran, which shows you how insane sometimes this all gets. But it seems to me that the way that the conspiracy theories took over in the aftermath of 9/11 really benefited Saudi Arabia, and to the point at which we don't connect Saudi Arabia materially with 9/11 the way it should be connected, right? And I think same thing is true of the Mueller report. The whole Russiagate problem, which guys like Aaron Matei and Taibbi and Greenwald, they can go off. So they like to go off on Russiagate and Russiagate, Russiagate. And on one level, I will agree with them. There was an obsessiveness in the coverage of Russiagate to the extent to which I believe was a problem, to the extent to which it actually hid the true mechanism behind what we call Russiagate. It wasn't that Russia was this grand player orchestrating everything. It was that Russia was actually a junior partner in a much larger system that was created by the United Arab Emirates and guys like Tom Barrack and Manafort, and Russia, which benefited through OPEC Plus. Eventually we can get to OPEC Plus, but we've actually, our eye has not been on the ball, and the ball really gets hit by Tom Barrack and the United Arab Emirates.
There were just two things I was going to add to that. First off, on the opposite end of that spectrum, you have these characters like Louise Mensch, who I don't know if I...
Yes, yeah.
She's
yeah.
going after me saying, oh, the Fed should talk to him because Val Brockschmidt disappeared. Turns out he's alive and well, but she wanted to sick the feds and the LAPD on me and yep. Barrett Brown because, oh, they must know something. They're friends with him. But, you know, it's so funny to me when we talk about this stuff, because you look at Alex Jones, it's like Roger Stone came along and Alex Jones used to be Mr. I'm against the police state. Soon as Roger Stone comes along, though, it's a whole different story. And, you know, I mentioned Louise Mensch, you know, you have these people that want to create a narrative that is very simplified, where it's, Trump is just Putin's puppet. But that ignores the fact that really Trump was a major screw up when it came to a lot of the arms treaties with Russia. So a lot of these things are not as simple as either the Alex Jones narrative or the, I don't know, sometimes I call it the Blue Anon narrative.
Yeah. And that's why I think the story of Tom Barrack and the United Arab Emirates is so important, because it actually gets grounded into something that's palpable and understandable, and that's the empire of oil. I mean, we understand oil makes sense. What is the motivation? What was going on? Oil makes sense. Kirill Dmitriev, who I mentioned earlier, who was working with a guy named Rick Gerson. Rick Gerson's brother, Mark Gerson, was an investor in Kushner, in one of Kushner's companies at one point. Kushner was investing in Gerson's medical aid organization in Israel. And Rick Gerson ends up working with Kirill Dmitriev. Kirill Dmitriev, he's the sovereign wealth guy who was investing alongside the United Arab Emirates. During the campaign, he predicted that eventually the United Arab, the Russia would join with OPEC in controlling the price of oil and the supply of oil. That had never happened before.
So this is OPEC Plus, right?
Well, this becomes OPEC Plus. This is so ever since Trump became president, suddenly Russia is agreeing to production cuts or increases to control the price of oil, along with Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. Saudi Arabia, of course, wants to hold its power, its grip over OPEC. And, you know, if Iran was able to normalize relations with the United States, have all of its sanctions relief, start to trade its oil and its gas on the open market, the center of gravity inside OPEC would change. That's one of the reasons why the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia want to keep Iran's oil and gas in the ground, all of that. But Kirill Dmitriev, right, is working with Rick Gerson on what? They actually came up with a document, that speech that Trump was going to give about the normalization of relationship between Russia and the United States. So you see, it's all this connective tissue, but it continues to come back to the United Arab Emirates, because Kirill Dmitriev is closely aligned with Mohammed bin Zayed and the United Arab Emirates. And so we're focusing a lot on what Putin was doing, but we're focusing on the IRA, but we're not focusing on Psy Group. We're not focusing on the United Arab Emirates. And all of this makes a ton of sense, because it's all about what? It's about the price of oil and the role of the Iran nuclear deal in upsetting the status quo of the empire of oil globally.
I mean, this is the biggest story of foreign influence peddling I think we've seen in a while.
Absolutely.
I
mean,
this is like some Robert Hansen stuff or Jonathan Pollard. I don't even know. This is wild. So I have a question for you then. So we talked about Iran. What do you think was the agenda behind Trump going after everything that Obama did with Cuba and then going so hard on Venezuela? You know, all these Elliot Abrams types and John Bolton types were around. What was that all about? How does that connect to all this in your opinion?
I think that's just smart politics. I think it's one of the reasons why he won Florida twice. I mean, the demographics are pretty clear. Is, you know, Latino or Latinx voters, if you prefer, particularly Cuban and South American voters, or voters of Cuban or South American descent.
Especially the older ones who may or may not have had relatives that benefited under Batista.
That's right. Right. They have a tendency to be conservative on these issues. And I think it was just smart politics. I think if Donald Trump knows one thing, he knows Florida politics, and he knows it pretty well. And he played that pretty well. And it just kind of made sense politically, frankly. Venezuela's oil is another issue entirely, because Venezuela has, I don't know where it is now. See, who has the largest reserves is always changing, not because of how much of the reserves are being tapped, but how much of the reserves are not being tapped. Because this is one of the problems you have. If you're Saudi Arabia, you've got this massive oil reserve and you're tapping it all the time, and you are losing your share of the world's reserves every time you pump a barrel and put it on the market and sell it. And so the trick is you want to keep some of your competitors who have comparable reserves from flooding the market and altering the price of oil and diminishing your profitability. I believe that was the main reason why the United States destroyed Iraq, was to keep their oil in the ground. Iraq was very, very close to being listed as in compliance with UN resolutions. Saddam Hussein made no bones about his desire to flood the market with oil and punish Saudi Arabia. There were even, you know, this is, I don't know if this is apocryphal to some people or considered conspiracy land, but, you know, there was talk at that time, and I do remember it, of him, maybe if he, when he gets his sanctions relief, of trading in euros instead of dollars. That probably wasn't going to happen because dollars is, was still a thing, but that it's kind of a the kind of threat you would expect Saddam Hussein to make. And by the, by Saudi Arabia engaging in 9/11, right, setting off 9/11, which sets off what? Sets off the wars in Afghanistan, but most specifically the war in Iraq, which was a war against an innocent bystander that had nothing to do with anything. It didn't threaten the United States. A lot of oil was kept in the ground. And so we're under the assumption in the often in, under the assumption and when we think of the empire of oil or oil wars, that, yeah, the United States is going to war to take the oil. The United States is going to war to take the oil. Much of what the empire of oil does is not go to war to take oil. It goes to war to keep oil in the ground. So the problem for Saudi Arabia is yeah, you get this benefit in the interim, the short period, short term, of keeping their oil in the ground, and you keep control of OPEC and of the price of oil. But over time, this their your share of the global reserve continues to decline. And at the time that I wrote the piece on Trump's oily presidency, Venezuela, because of the collapse of the oil economy, the collapse of the government, sanctions that followed the on the Maduro regime, they had the second largest oil reserves in the world at that point. So we're talking about liquid gold, not the natural gas that the Iranians and the Russians are sitting on. And so that makes control of Venezuela very, very important, and at least makes demonization of them very, very important. I think that this is one of the things that Trump was doing in going after Cuba. We put that aside. That's politics. There was a significant Venezuelan expat voting population in Florida that people are maybe not aware of. But the key thing about going after Venezuela was what? It was about keeping that oil off the market. And the more you create tension with oil producing countries, the more you get momentary market psychology bumps in the price of oil, because that's another thing you do. Why did Trump drag out the end of the Iran nuclear deal? Why did he do that? Remember, it was a will he, won't he, will he, won't he. Sources say he'll do it this time. Oh, no, he renewed it for another month. He's going to do it maybe in another month. If you go back and look at the oil market, every time he said something about Iran or every time a story came out of the administration that he was considering finally jettisoning the deal, the price of oil went up. The price of oil went up, and then it went down, and then it went up and went down. It's a speculator's dream. Donald Trump was an oil speculator's dream. And Donald Trump, who loves to talk on the phone, I guarantee you was talking to people who were speculating on the oil market about what he was going to do so they could place their bets in advance.
One second, Harry. Are you trying to say that Donald Trump, despite saying that he was America first, maybe he was a little bit oil speculators first?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I mean, if you look at – there's a reason why his first foreign trip was to Saudi Arabia so that he could go sword dance with the sheiks. I mean – then we get into to Steven Schwartzman of Blackstone and their scheme with he had a scheme with Jared Kushner to have the big infrastructure. Remember their infrastructure week and their infrastructure deal? That was going to be a $400 million deal in which Saudi Arabia was privately funding infrastructure construction inside the United States. At the same time, a guy named Thomas Barrack.
Good old Tommy B.
Tommy B, Mr. Ubiquitous, the Where's Waldo of Arab influence, of Saudi Arabian and Emirati influence.
It's like the 6 degrees of Tommy Barrack. You know, there, I used to play six degrees of Adnan Khashoggi. Now I got a new game to play.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good one. That would actually work really well. That would be, that'd be better than the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia chart that I should have behind me. We can play that game instead. So, Barrack was working on what? A deal to get nuclear plant technology, nuclear energy technology to Saudi Arabia. Who else was working on nuclear energy technology to Saudi Arabia? A guy named Michael Flynn. He was also working on that. As a matter of fact, they had, there's the picture of him during Trump's inauguration on the phone with his buddy saying, "We got it made, my friend. We got it made." And you want to know who was involved in that? A guy named Elliot Broidy. Elliot Broidy, who was connected to George Nader, and Elliot Broidy, who was part of a hacking campaign that was being conducted by the United Arab Emirates and Qatar against one another. It's all there. It's all there. But we've spent a lot of time on Putin, 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 Putin.
And well, we spent a lot of time. Nowadays I see, what is it? Moscow Mitch. And then on the other end, I see Beijing Biden. But no one ever talks about the UAE or Saudi Arabia.
Which is where all the action is. It's all there. Because I got to tell you something. China, what is China without gas imports from the Middle East? They got a lot of coal, okay, but they also get a lot of coal from Australia. But yeah, that Chinese market is a big deal to the United Arab Emirates and to Iran. Iran would like nothing more than to sell its gas reserves to China. And Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, that scares the bejesus out of them, the idea of Iran being able to do that. So that's where, you know, you get Israel and Bibi Netanyahu come in, because one of the only friends that the Palestinians had at the end of the Obama administration were Qatar and Iran. Huh. What do you know? You mean two targets during the Trump administration were two of the only friends? There's, as a matter of fact, after Donald Trump tried to zero out, or I think he did zero out most aid to the Palestinians, it was Qatar that stepped up to provide hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to the Palestinians. So it's all right there, JG. I wrote it in 2019, and I went back and I took a look at it a couple of days ago when I knew we were going to do this, or yesterday when I knew we were going to do this.
Well, I saw you tweet it when the Tommy B came out.
Yes.
When that news came out, I think you said, "I knew it all along. I told you so."
It's all right there. What I did is I took a lot of information and I put it all together in a narrative, and it's all hyperlinked. It's not really that complicated. It's maybe a little convoluted, maybe a little complicated, but it's anybody who's been following American Empire or has been interested in American Empire, has been interested in doing something about American Empire, and anybody who is interested in climate change and about hydrocarbons and carbon in the atmosphere, you know, the climate change is a byproduct of American empire, of the empire of oil, straight up. And there are a lot of Americans, particularly people on the libertarian left and the libertarian right and the progressive left, who are critics of American empire. They know that oil is crucial, and how crucial oil was to Trump's candidacy and presidency is maybe the most underreported story of the last decade.
So I got to ask, since you mentioned Flynn, he got pardoned. What about the other two that got pardoned? The other two clown mobster, B-movie mobster figures. Anything to say about Stone and Bannon?
Well, I think Stone and Bannon got pardoned because they know where all the bodies are. Probably more than anybody. I mean, that's just smart. That's good business if you're Donald Trump, because they know a lot. Now,
I remember, and I don't know if this is true or not. It was in the Michael Wolff book, you know, and I've seen people criticize it. But I think Bannon said in there, he's like, I'm telling you, Kushner is going to crack like an egg, which is probably true.
Probably true. Well, now Kushner just started his new investment firm. Did you see that? He's got a new investment firm.
Tell me a little bit more. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, new investment firm that's going to be partially headquartered in Israel, and now is time for him to start collecting on all of the goodwill that he fostered in creating the Abraham Accords, because there's a lot of money to cash in on. Bannon, I think Bannon is actually just a guy who likes to suck his own you know what.
And, yeah, as Anthony Scaramucci said, "Hey, Scaramucci, yes, please come on my show. I've been trying to get him."
Get the mooch. It's kind of the same thing with Stone. These are people who are high on the drug of themselves. But I don't, you know, they did not have the same material. Although the thing about Bannon that I find interesting is both he and Flynn were connected with Cambridge Analytica and heavily intersected with. And that's, so we spent a lot of time on the IRA and Putin, but we didn't spend as much time as, or at least as much time as we should on Cambridge Analytica. I think that's a story that never got fully exposed to the American people. And nobody knows about Psy Group. And that campaign, that 2016 campaign, was filled with influence operations. And
data mining in a lot of cases, right? A
lot of data mining. And the biggest influence operation of all was the one in plain sight, and that was Facebook. So, you know, again, our eye has not really been on the ball. When I think of Russia's role in this, because I am not like this cadre of I don't know what they are, progressives, who the Russiagate deniers. I mean, there's something there to Russiagate. I've read the Mueller report. I read every damn word of the Mueller report. There's a lot there. And Kirill Dmitriev, his name pops up for a reason. And Putin is connected to Semyon Mogilevich and connected to Chabad, which is connected to Kushner and connected to Bibi Netanyahu. And Bibi Netanyahu and Putin got along swimmingly. And I have a lot of that in the piece. You know, I think Putin had every rational reason to be involved in this axis of influence with Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, because the United States did nothing but humiliate Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, kept a drunken buffoon in power, sent, and that would be Yeltsin, sent the Harvard boys over to engage in hyper neoliberal shock therapy on the Russian economy. A lot of that, I think, was designed. The neocons, you know, after in the post-Cold War period of the 90s, really made no bones about wanting to go into Russia and making sure it could never rise again to challenge the United States.
That was probably Brzezinski's big dream too.
Yeah, that Brzezinski's big dream, that's where he intersects. And Brzezinski's big dream was also about what? Having some kind of strategic control over the high ground in Central Asia, also known as Afghanistan, on the grand chessboard. So, you know, I think that Putin was an incredibly rational actor in this. Was Donald Trump his puppet? See, I don't think Donald Trump needed to be a puppet. I think Donald Trump was a known quantity, and I think it was pretty obvious what he was going to do. And there was a lot of direct influence coming into Donald Trump, because the story is that Donald Trump has few people that he saw as his peer. Tom Barrack was one of them. And Tom Barrack was able to have peer-to-peer influence on Donald Trump in ways that even Stone and Bannon were not. Tom Barrack is not somebody who Donald Trump has ever turned on or said anything against, and I think that that's quite notable. He's one of the few. All of these other characters around Donald Trump have at one point or another been called a schmuck, a liar, a fool, an idiot, whatever. Not Tom Barrack. And Tom Barrack was the conduit for the United Arab Emirates. They gave Tom Barrack like a wish list of things that he would like, that they would like to have Donald Trump do in 6 months, 12 months, and a year. Tom Barrack comes with a wish list. He was getting verbiage put in Donald Trump's speeches there was a speech about energy in the Middle East. It really pleased the United Arab Emirates. So, you know, I think what's interesting is that there was a convergence of interests among the United Arab Emirates, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. The sort of the ground zero for that would be the famous Seychelles meeting, which happens in, I think it was January 11th, 2017, right before the inauguration. Eric Prince, Betsy DeVos's brother, is famously there.
Mr. Blackwater.
Kirill Dmitriev is there. And so is Mohammed bin Zayed. And there it is, folks. It's right there. It's right there. And all three of them had one thing that they all wanted to accomplish, and that was the end of the Iran nuclear deal. And, you know, think about it from Russia's point of view. Probably one of the worst things that could happen in the Middle East for Russia, aside from losing its warm water port in Syria, which it desperately wants, have that port in the Mediterranean, would be to lose its power and influence over Iran. And when Obama scores that Iran nuclear deal, it radically alters the geopolitical landscape in the Middle East. It radically changes the landscape for Israel. It radically changes the landscape for Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates. And a denouement between Iran and Russia, between Iran and the United States, would completely neuter Russia's ability to be the guarantor and protector of Iran.
I was just going to add to that. You know, I don't really get as deep into the Russia stuff just because it causes a million and one arguments, as you alluded to. But the bottom line for me is, you know, all these people that want to defend Trump over Russia, I mean, even he couldn't even negotiate with Russia. He did very poorly at it. I think it was the Stark Treaties. He screwed that up. We just had the arms controls talks with Biden. And you know what? It seems like Biden did a better job with Putin than Trump did.
But, you know, I think all of those are sort of ancillary. I think the more important thing for Vladimir Putin, I think he had a couple things. One, I think one of the reasons why we know about these sort of ham-handed, sloppy campaigns on Facebook by the IRA is because they wanted us to know about it. I think one level of what was going on for Russia was that they wanted to say to the US intelligence community, oh, we saw what you did in Ukraine, and we saw what you've been doing inside Russia for the last 8 years. We saw what you did, Hillary Clinton and Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt. We're going to do the same thing to you, and you're not going to be able to do a damn thing about it. I actually think the U.S. intelligence community got its ass handed to it with guys like, what's propeller head guy? Why am I losing his name? The first guy in Russiagate, the goofball, I forget his name. See, I've already forgotten his name, who we thought was an agent, but he really wasn't an agent. Anyway, I think a lot of these things were basically breadcrumbs that were being left for the U.S. intelligence agency to follow down all these rabbit holes, say, oh, there's an influence campaign here, and there's a secret agent here, and there's a guy here.
And there's the Steele dossier.
And the Steele dossier. Like the Steele dossier, as soon as he knew Steele was on the case, they were feeding him garbage. It's a typical counterintelligence practice. When you know that there's somebody trying to uncover your intelligence operation, you feed them red herrings.
So it was so crazy, not to interrupt you, but it was so crazy with the Steele dossier, because everyone was talking about, oh, Trump got peed on and they taped it. And then everyone ignores like Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. They're getting bribed into silence.
That's right. So again, classic misdirection, right? So I think that he wanted to slap the U.S. intelligence community, and he did that. And I think it was deserved because of what the United States was doing and influence operations inside Russia and the color revolutions and whatnot. That's just the way the spy versus spy game is played. And I think another thing is that they wanted revenge for the decimation of the Russian economy, which was contracting by 3 to 3.7% after Obama opened up the spigot on fracking. I mean, it's not complicated stuff. It's not evil. He's against democracy and he wants to create an authoritarian planet. No, this is money and oil and power. All of the things that have dominated global relations since the United States ascended. And really, you could say, if you take many different permutations, this is as old as empire itself.
So I know I want to let you go because we've been going for an hour here, and I don't want to keep you for another half hour like we always end up doing. But just in closing, looking at Biden, and I know people are going to say because of the arms control thing I said, oh, is he becoming a super Biden supporter? No, I'm just saying I think he, you know, did a little bit better with the talks than the Trump did. But what do you think about President Biden so far? What's the trajectory looking like in your opinion?
Yikes. it's, Well, I'll say this. He holds a press conference and he doesn't make any news. He doesn't tweet. He doesn't. The news cycle ends every day at about 4:30 Eastern time. He does have high marks on the virus handling of the pandemic. I think that's going to be put in jeopardy by the CDC and their new masking requirements. I think that there's a potential backlash that's going to come from that. I don't subscribe to any isms. I have no real ideological center to me whatsoever. I
guess the true independent.
Well, I'll put it, you know what it is, JG, is I spent my undergraduate and graduate years studying fascism. And as a result of studying fascism in the 20th century, I studied all the isms. And I've followed politics my whole life. And I just find that ideologies and isms are traps. They're just traps. They're utopian. They have some utility insofar as an ideological point of view can push the envelope on where policy can go. But ultimately, policy is sausage. And sausage is comprised of all kinds of different things. It's not just, you know, grade A chuck. It's all the parts too. And policy is how things get implemented. And when I look at Biden's policy agenda and the policies like this child tax credit thing, which is really just a form of universal basic income, by the way, it's just a form of it. I think if I was a progressive, I would be pleased with how surprisingly progressive the administration has been on some of these economic issues, at least economic issues. Geopolitically, you know, I think there's some disappointment about Israel and Gaza, which I would understand. I don't think he has been entirely bellicose, but he's not ending the forever wars. Those are not ending. They're being curtailed. They're being sort of repackaged. That they're not ending. There were strikes in Somalia about a week ago. So America, he's just the latest president to drop bombs. They've all dropped bombs except for Carter.
Back to normal, right?
It's kind of, yeah, back to normal. Now, I understand those who would say that Donald Trump was at least a break from the normal, at least at the beginning, the people who said, we just got to break this. And I do understand the point of view of those who are so opposed to American empire that they say the only way that we can maybe end American empire is to destroy it from within. And Donald Trump was a very good tool for that, perhaps. Although I would make the argument that American empire actually did quite well under Donald Trump. So particularly the military-industrial complex. But Biden's presidency, I think, it has the potential of being a one-term presidency.
Why do you think that?
Because the country is so discombobulated, and because of the way the map is stacked, because it's not about aggregate numbers. It's about picking off states. It's about the outsized power of North Dakota and South Dakota and Alabama and Arkansas and how you can pile up electoral college votes. I think also immigration and crime are going to be very potent forces in electoral politics over the next 2, 4, 6, and 8 years.
Did you see the thing with Kamala going to Guatemala and saying, please don't come here, please don't come here? And then she says, I want to look into the root causes of poverty and violence. And I'm like, what about your U.S. foreign policies? That's done it. Maybe you should give them reparations.
Well, and see, this is the thing. This is why I'm pessimistic about American politics, JG, is because we're talking about this immigration crisis. There's really no immigration crisis at the border. The real crisis is that there are numerous farms, particularly in the West, who don't have people to pick the food. They need workers. And Americans aren't out there doing that work. Those people who are coming here to do that work are not there doing that work because of the bottleneck at the border. The reason why you have the bottleneck at the border is not just because there are jobs here, but because the United States foreign policy going back to the beginning of the Cold War has completely and totally gutted much of Central America and South America. And also because you have the beginning of climate migration. I wrote a piece about this a couple of years ago for Truthout about empire and climate. We already have climate migrants coming out of Guatemala and climate migrants coming out of Honduras. They did not do anything materially to contribute to climate. The number one contributor to climate, the climate crisis, is the United States, period. The United States individually through consumption and use of hydrocarbons, and the United States empire through its propagation of the empire of oil, which has created the conditions for climate change globally.
That's the big thing you always hear. I keep hearing it now. I keep hearing people starting to blame the immigrants and, oh, the climate refugee crisis, the immigrants. It's not the third world starting all this.
Nope.
We are the biggest factors in the coming climate crisis.
It's here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's here, baby. Yeah. You know, it is here. And I'll give you another one. And this is a piece that I'm working on right now about China. People say, well, you know, why should we be in the Paris Climate Accords? Why should we do anything on climate if China's not going to do anything on climate? Well, let's see. So China's factories produce what? Billions of tons of plastic landfill fodder for American consumers. Those factories are burning for who? For American consumers. That all that stuff is being put in what? Ships that are being shipped across the ocean to American consumers. Ships that are used are a huge source of climate hydrocarbon burning and carbon emissions. So it's the American. Much of China's emissions are ultimately the responsible of American consumers and American corporations who, like Walmart, who rose to American consumer dominance before Amazon did in the 90s, based on what? On Clinton continuing to renew most favored nation trading status, which allowed Walmart to offshore all that production there.
So I'm going to end it here, but I have to go on one really brief rant because I've been really annoyed by it lately, and I think you're going to be the one that understands it.
Okay.
I keep hearing from both right-wing Trumpists and people who want to say, oh, Trump really did want to end the forever wars, people on the left that want to still cling to that narrative. And I'm getting so utterly tired of it. People saying, well, he was blocked by the deep state. This is a guy who hired Elliot Abrams. He brought in John Bolton. Oh, he couldn't outmaneuver the deep state. Well, maybe he shouldn't be a loser. He calls everyone else a loser. Maybe he should try to outmaneuver the so-called deep state. And, you know, I just want to say, the thing I hate most about Trump, and I know I'm being very partial here, but I really, looking back on Trump, have a real loathing for his presidency, because I think he set us back 10 to 20 years in regards to addressing one of the biggest problems we have today. We live in what amounts to, in my opinion, a gerontocracy in which our institutions are atrophied, they are fossilizing, they are stuck in a Cold War mindset. And you know what? We could have called for reform. There does need to be a draining of the swamp a little bit. But now, when people hear reform or drain the swamp, they think Donald Trump. They think what Jeb Bush called the chaos president. And I think Trump's worst contribution is the fact that he has set us back 20 years to the point where people aren't going to want to reform these institutions because they're going to remember this clown.
Well, and also, he took all of
the... Sorry for becoming the angry populist white man there.
He took all of the terms of the debate and scrambled them so that we actually can't have a debate about how to drain the swamp, how to end the empire. We can't have that debate anymore because all of the lines have been redrawn by his shameless willingness to lie about everything. He's basically made inquiry nearly impossible, and that's why I get so circumspect when you ask me about Biden's presidency. Look, I'm no Biden fan. I am a fan of having the news cycle end every day at 4:30. I think that's great. And there are things that he's done environmentally that I like. You know, but a lot of that is actually remediation of the things that were done under Trump. And I think that really Trump's most of the damage that Trump did was environmental, even more than I hear you on all that. And I agree with you. on the political zeitgeist and the possibility of overcoming the lingering issues of the Cold War. In many ways, I think Donald Trump was kind of a nostalgic throwback to the Cold War, as a matter of fact. And also he was a denial mechanism for those who want to refuse to take responsibility for what empire has wrought.
It was a lot of those voters were the type of people that were like, why can't we just go back to the good old days of the 80s and Ronald Reagan and cocaine?
Yeah. So there is all of that. But I think that the damage that was done environmentally was staggering. And a lot of that damage that was done environmentally was in the service of the empire of oil and what I call the real deep state, not the phony deep state of bureaucrats working in cubicles at Foggy Bottom. That's the deep state. All of these people who are sort of mid-level pencil pushers. To me, the deep state is seen in a Venn diagram. The Venn diagram, you would have the military-industrial complex, the defense industry, the oil industry, and Wall Street. And where the three of those overlap in the center of that Venn diagram, that's the real deep state. The real deep state does not meet in conference rooms over bagels at 8 in the morning somewhere in Washington, D.C. The real deep state meets in burled walnut conference rooms in corporate headquarters and on golf courses and in country clubs where people who don't want to be seen, who don't have to be seen, but wield huge amounts of power, huge amounts of influence over hedge funds and oil companies and defense companies, where they meet and they rub elbows, that's where the real deep state is. And nobody was a greater servant to that real deep state than Donald Trump.
Well, folks, if you want to read about the real deep state, I suggest reading Gore Vidal, Chalmers Johnson, and of course, J.P. Satilli, the News Vandal. I think we covered a lot of ground, and I think I got a lot of my anger out on Trump presidency. He's ruined the word populism. Now he's pretty much ruined everything, including the environment. So how can my listeners, though, keep in touch with your work and keep reading it? Because you're one of the best news sources out there. The Rundown is a great resource.
You can go to newsvandal.com and sign up for the Rundown. I do it every day. I've been doing it every day for now 11 years. And it's just a bunch of headlines from news sources all around the web, the internet, the intertube. So you just sign up for it. You get every day. When you look at it, you're going to see, you just read the headlines. That's all you do. Just read the headlines in order. I put the headlines, I stack them so that they tell a story unto themselves. And then if you want to dig deeper into a story, you click on it. But newsvandal.com, the box will pop up. Put in your email and you get the Rundown. And good luck. Because it's a heck of a news cycle every day.
I just wanted to say, I mentioned Gore Vidal and Chalmers Johnson because I think you're one of the few voices keeping up with the work that they did exposing the empire.
I thank you for that, but I don't put myself into that pantheon. And although the Chalmers Johnson, I did get to meet him, and I was the contributing author of a book called Japan in the Fascist Era. I wrote the first chapter of that book. It was a collected work that was edited by the great E. Bruce Reynolds, who was an expert on Thailand and World War II, and Pee Boon Songkram, who was Thailand's sort of ostensible little fascist leader. And Chalmers Johnson did write a little blurb for our book. So I have a direct connection to Chalmers Johnson, who was really one of the greats in terms of understanding the mechanism of U.S. empire and the military-industrial complex.
We'll have to talk more about that next time you're on. Maybe share a Chalmers Johnson story with us. I want to thank you again, J.P. Satilli, the News Vandal. People, listen to the News Vandal. Get rid of that Super Mill Vitality Pill bullcrap, Alex Jones InfoWars. That's nothing. The News Vandal has got you covered on the real news. Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with J.P. Satilli, the News Vandal. I think anytime J.P. and I come together for a show, it is always a fascinating ride, and I hope that's how you feel as well. As always, I have to plug the Parallax Views Patreon. I've been adding more content on there, including video interviews and archived shows. Hopefully, we'll get back to doing some bonus shows that will be exclusive to the Patreon. Have gotten a real upsurge in support in the past month, and I really, really appreciate that. It has been difficult times. I'm taking care of a family member right now and just trying to keep everything going and doing it with a pretty crazy production schedule, which a lot of people tell me I should maybe slow down on, but you know, 24-hour news cycles. In any case, I've got some shows coming up soon for you guys that I think everyone will enjoy. Abby Martin recently spoke to me. That episode will be out hopefully in the next week or so. Also spoke with Stephen Walt, the international relations scholar, and many others in the past week. Those interviews, I hope, will be published later this week. And if you want to help out, help me keep producing the show and getting great guests, please just consider even a $1 monthly donation to the Parallax Views Patreon. There's also the $5 tier where you get all the bonus content, such as video interviews and archived editions of past Parallax Views programs. And then there's the $10 and $15 tiers. And those get a producer's credit, which leads us to the producer's credit shout out. So, shout outs to James, Jamie, Catherine, Brian, Amelia, Ork, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Martin, Chase, Gratz, Mickey, and the Warnerd. If you can, consider joining them in supporting me on Patreon, or if you want, send me a DM or an email, and you can always send me a donation through PayPal. So there's that as well. And with that being said, let's get to the track that I played part of at the beginning of the show. Here's the closer.
Control Aramco, so that puts them into Exxon, Texaco, and Mobile Oil. They're all over New Jersey, Louisville, St. Louis, Missouri. And that's only what we know about. There's a hell of a lot more we don't know about, because all of those Arab petrodollars are washed through Switzerland and Canada and the biggest banks in this country.
Arab petrodollars. Arab petrodollars. Arab petrodollars.
Did you learn things that you didn't think you could tell?
Absolutely. I've learned lots and lots of things I don't feel comfortable talking about. Interests, the real special interest behind coup d'etat all over the globe. The idea of coup d'etat is an amazing idea, and it goes on. I mean, I sat with a bunch of oil men, very powerful oil men. At a
coup d'etat meaning overthrow a government.
Overthrow a government.
The world is a business. It is the international system of currency, which determines the totality of life on this planet.
There is only one holistic system of systems. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, reichmarks, rims, rubles, pounds, and shekels.
The world is a business.
Arab petrodollars.
The world is a business.
And I sat on Fifth Avenue, this 15,000 square foot apartment, just around the corner on Fifth Avenue, one of these brownstones. Guy owns the whole building, an oil man. And he and his friends played a little game at this table where they made a guess. They said, next country to be overthrown for its energy assets. And the one guy who was having the party, the richest one of them all, he had said at this dinner party, he said, "What? First question, what's the money for?" "Well, I buy media. I buy media, I buy stories, and I buy op-ed pieces, and I buy front page stories, and then I buy mobs. I pay off mobs to show up in the street on demand. That's what I do."
"Let me tell you what's gonna happen. This way you can prepare yourself. He's going to tell you that I am to be released. You're going to protest. You'll probably threaten to resign. But in the end, I will be released. The reason I'll be released is the same reason you think I'll be convicted. I do rub shoulders with some of the most vile, sadistic men calling themselves leaders today. But some of those men are the enemies of your enemies. And while the biggest arms dealer in the world is your boss, the President of the United States, who ships more merchandise in a day than I do in a year, sometimes it's embarrassing to have his fingerprints on the guns. Sometimes he needs a freelancer like me to supply forces he can't be seen supplying.
Did you learn things that you didn't think you could tell?
Absolutely. I've learned lots and lots of things I don't feel comfortable talking about.
Dollars.
The world is a business. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet.